Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to episode 131 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my life's dream and career as a radio presenter with one big regret: never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. Now, on this episode of the podcast, I am joined by keyboard wizard, singer and songwriter Christopher Holland, a man whose session and touring work has featured the likes of Green on Red, Squeeze, Sam Brown, Elton John, Ray Davis, The Stereophonics, to name but a few. A hugely talented musician who joined the Paul Weller Band for the Heliocentric Tour in 2000. Chris is also part of Jules Holland's Rhythm and Blues Orchestra, and yes, that is his big brother, so we'll talk studio work, like the fabulous co-write I'm Gone, which Paul delivered lead vocals on, along with TV show Later and The Hootenanny, and playing with Paul as part of that setup live. In between working with other artists, he continues with his first passion of writing, recording, and producing his own fabulous music, so we're going to dig into all this stuff on the podcast. Let's get into it. Christopher Holland, thank you for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Dan. Yeah, glad to finally sort of meet you here and to be doing this after quite a while, isn't it? I think it was the beginning of lockdown. I was sort of mentioned about it, and I've been really enjoying a lot of the podcast since. I've got to say, it's an amazing achievement on your behalf to get it all together like this, you know. So there's nothing else quite like this, is there? I was thinking, because it's quite a unique thing, you know, for an artist, you know, to have all these contributions from different people. And so a lot of people I know, but a lot of people I don't. But it's like you kind of get to know about him through it and about other people, which you wouldn't know about, you know. It's fascinating, you know. Maybe he's listening to them, enjoying them so much he doesn't want to do it yet, because he wants to hear all the different guests and what they've got to say about
That could be it.
You ought to have a big party at the end and invite everyone that's been on, you know, like they could all come and it'd be like, this is your life, wouldn't it? And he'd sort of turn up and say, oh, good work. And yeah, I hope Paul's listening somehow, and then you manage to get him on at some point and your dream comes true.
Fingers crossed. Well, look, we're having a lovely journey getting there, and who knows how long it will take. But you know what? It's a real blast kind of talking to so many amazing people and digging into their careers and their stories about Paul and their lives and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to do the same with you. And there are lots of Weller connections that we'll dig into. But the thing I find fascinating from your point of view is that, I mean, this is a real musical family, because obviously, you know, Jules Holland, your brother, your twin brother plays drums, I think. That's right. So your house as kids must have just been horrendous amount of noise. As a parent, I mean, I just want peace and quiet, but that wouldn't have been your household, right?
Well, it was such a different time then, I guess, as well, yeah, because there wasn't so many distractions like there are now, I suppose, with the internet and stuff. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't exactly like the Brady Bunch or the Partridge Family, you know, but it was definitely sort of a musical sort of upbringing, you know. My earliest memories of my mum used to play a little bit of piano, and my uncle played piano, and we had a player piano at my nan's house, and there was always a sort of lot of piano music sort of being played. And my dad was more into classical music. He'd start playing a lot of sort of, I think it was Wagner and sort of like really extreme classical music, and he'd be obsessed with these hi-fis and getting this amazing sound. But there'd always be some kind of music coming out of the house, you know. Yeah, I remember when I was really young, my brother, older brother, because it was about 9 years difference, used to play a lot of boogie-woogie piano. So I'd be trying to sleep and hear all this kind of stuff in my bed. You know, it was really inspiring though. And I thought, wow, that sounds pretty cool.
He's pretty good at it, right?
Yeah. Pretty good, you know. And he must have only been about 16 or something. And I was probably sort of 6, 7 or 8. But it sounded amazing, you know. And I saw the dogs just turned up. You know. I remember asking him to give me a few little tips, you know, and show me a few licks, even when I was 7 or 8, which he kindly did. And I think you get the bug quite early from that, I guess, you know. And then same sort of time, the early formation of Squeeze were rehearsing around the house in the front room a bit. So there was Glenn and Chris from Squeeze getting together with the original drummer and the bass player, and listening to all that stuff was really inspiring, you know, growing up.
I was going to ask how you got your share of the instrument, because was there just one piano that you were all, you know, and as soon as Jules is off, you're straight on, or how did that work?
It was kind of a grand piano that my dad seemed to get some free from somewhere, and it managed to just fit in this little room at the side of our house. So we always just used to play that a little bit, but then he got this thing for Squeeze. The original thing was an RMI electric piano, which he then handed down to me at some point. And then he had this Polymoog, which was, it was like the most amazing sort of synthesizer that you could sort of imagine in the 70s. I think they're about £3,000 then, you know, but that was back in sort of early 70s. I remember just putting headphones on and you'd sort of go in this different world. It was like a sort of spaceship taking off, all these sounds and these possibilities, you know. So that was definitely a big kind of inspiration, you know, listening to the vintage, those keyboards, which weren't vintage then, but then I've sort of started collecting some of those old keyboards since, you know, I guess from that. Yeah, they'd sort of go off to the pub later, and then I'd sneak in with my brother and just, we'd start having a little play when we were about 8 or 9, I guess, you know, I don't know, but it was just a natural thing, I suppose, wasn't it, at that time, that you do.
Was there ever any doubt that this would be your world as a career? Did you do anything else? Did you try anything else? Or was it straight into being a musician?
Not really. I didn't really think of it as a career. It just seemed like a fun thing to do, you know, and it just sort of took over, I guess. And then I sort of got really obsessed with just sort of writing song ideas, although I didn't really think of them as songs, but just little sort of pieces of music, you know. And then my older brother when I got a bit older, in my sort of early teens, he kind of handed down a reel-to-reel four track that he used to use, which at the time nobody really had ways of recording stuff, you know, because it was before sort of internet and stuff and before digital stuff. So it was an analog reel-to-reel TIAC thing. So I kind of started using that to record basic little songs with my Casio keyboard. We kind of formed a little band at school with my brother on drums. It was harder then to meet other like-minded musicians, I think. Nowadays, it seems a little easier, doesn't it, because of Facebook and all that sort of stuff. But there didn't seem to be anyone that age who was really into playing. We managed to find a couple of mutual friends at a party, I think, when we were about 14 or 15. There was a couple of girls that we vaguely knew who played guitar and sang, and it was a really sweet sound they got. It was a bit like some 60s kind of beat group and things, and they look good, sounded good. So we kind of formed a group together with them and used to play at local parties and a few pubs if we could get in and stuff, and we built up quite a big following locally, you know, with that. So that was quite a good experience. And a bit later on, we got spotted by, you know, Dick Robinson from Magpie. He was on that originally, and he kind of quite liked us, so he kind of spotted us and he wanted us to go on a TV show he was doing called Free Time. So we went on that, and then suddenly we got quite a bit of exposure, and a bit later on got signed up to Miles Copeland's label and all that stuff, and done a few records with that. It all just happened naturally, really, without kind of a big sort of plan. I think at that time it was just quite an innocent thing, just doing it for fun, you know, and then suddenly it becomes like a job again.
And what a job it's been, man. I mean, the amount of amazing people you've worked with, the music you're creating of your own. You mentioned Chris and Glenn and Squeeze, which we'll have to dig into some of those memories. There is a Weller connection with Chris Difford, who has been on the podcast, but I love those guys. They're absolutely fabulous. But people like Ray Davis, we've worked with, I think, Stereophonics, Tom Jones. If I were to, I mean, this is massive, but who would you kind of go, actually, if I were to pick two or three career highlights, and we probably should mention Weller as one of these, right? But yeah.
The amazing thing about the big band, which obviously came to later on, but it was that there's so many artists you get to play with, you know, just not but it's only you just sort of go in to do, so you do one or two songs with them, but it's not like you're part of their thing really. But it's incredible just to be able to do that. So that's why that is such an amazing gig, you know. But the first thing I started doing like that was probably when I started sort of about 19 or 20, and that band Green or Red, I don't know if you remember them from America, but they'd just done an album with Glyn Johns, and his son Ethan was playing with them as well, which is why I met him, which is weird because I'm doing stuff with him now a bit. But anyway, so I started playing with them a bit, and that was an incredible experience because we used to go on tour. I mean, it's the first big tours I did, you know, pretty much everywhere, Japan and American stuff. And that was a big sort of inspiration, I suppose, to start with, because they were like a real rock and roll kind of band, you know, and I was a bit younger. And some of the conversations they'd have in the tour bus, and it was all like real, it was just inspiring, you know, listening to all that. So that was a big thing to start with. But I mean, my big hero is obviously someone like Stevie Wonder, which I met when we did the Queen's Jubilee gig, which was pretty amazing. I mean, I've never actually played with him, but I sort of almost got on stage with him when he was doing it, because I was sort of standing at the back watching, and it was almost like I was there on stage. And that, but he's one of my biggest heroes. We did a thing with Stevie Winwood, which was pretty amazing as well. I think it was in Cheltenham. He came up and did Georgia with us, and he was playing piano, and I was just playing a bit of organ behind him. But his voice is it's just amazing, isn't it, when you hear Stevie Winwood and his whole thing.
Yeah. He's on the list for the podcast, although I haven't yet managed to find any contact details whatsoever. It was a Weller connection because he played on, I think it was Sandy Road, I think he played on.
Yeah, same as Dr. John, because I was going to say he was another one, but sadly he's no longer with us. But that was another highlight, I'd say. I mean, there's so many, it's hard to think, you know.
Yeah,
and I feel really fortunate to have played with so many people, you know. But it's interesting, you know, growing up, you don't really think about it, you know, because I remember memories of seeing the Jam on the Top of the Pops and things like that. And a friend at school was a huge Jam fan. I sort of was aware of them, but I wasn't that into it. And he sort of lent me their first album, and he was obsessed with his vinyl collection. He had a green sort of parka. He's only sort of 14 or so, to have this sort of chopper bike with all wing mirrors on it. And he was real mod, you know, but he sort of gave me this first album to listen to. And I got really into that sound, you know, and you could feel the energy, you know. And then I remember going up to the Marquee a few times when I was a bit young, with my older brother to watch Squeeze. And I think the Jam have been on some of those gigs at the same time. And there was one at the Greyhound, I vaguely remember, the pub isn't there anymore, but they played at that, I think. So there were a few sort of those early sort of punk times, well, not mid-punk times, where the energy was just so sort of uplifting, you know, when you're quite young and you sort of hear these songs. It was, that was an amazing time, really, you know. And I don't know if that will, I don't know if it's the same now, is it, in a way, the feeling of that, because there was no sort of phones or anything, and everyone was just in the moment. It was just quite special, I think. But yeah, I remember being part of that whole, that sort of time. It felt quite magical, you know. And then managing, looking at that, thinking later on I'd be playing with Paul Weller and Squeeze and things like that, seems quite odd, you know. But sort of things just work out. And you don't really plan it sometimes. It just sort of goes in a certain way, you know.
Talk me through the life of a touring musician then. So you mentioned about, you know, you're out on the road at a pretty young age, and you're traveling the world with Green on Red there. To me, is, you know, if I'm thinking about like my, I've got an 8-year-old, if I'm thinking like in 10 years time, he's suddenly off with these rockers traveling around. I mean, that terrifies me as a dad, but I mean, were you nervous? Is there any kind of trepidation? Was it straight in, this is really exciting, this is kind of, this is the life I want?
Sort of been signed up to this record label with Miles Copeland, who IRS Records, and we'd done a few records with that. And then that had sort of petered out a little bit. And we were sort of doing other things. And I started playing in this local band, which are doing quite well, just for fun. But my main thing, I've always been sort of writing and doing, just you know, constantly using it as a vehicle to write. But then the offer came up. I think it's because Green on Red's tour manager was from Deptford or something, and they were looking for someone. I don't know quite how it came up, but I got a call, and then I'd never really heard of them, but I got sent a couple of records, and I thought, it sounds kind of good, interesting. And then turned up to the audition. It was like a rehearsal studio somewhere in London anyway. And then the first person I met was this roadie called Captain Scarlet. I don't know where he's now, but he was amazing, like huge, big sort of old punk, you know, and he was a lovely guy. And Ethan Johns, who was drumming with him at the time, because I think he needed the experience, because his dad had just produced the album. It was an interesting mixture. So I met them, and then we went into the studio, and Dan Stewart and Chuck Prophet turned up. It was just such a brilliant sort of sound, you know, that they got. And we all seemed to just gel. So the next thing I knew, we were just off to Europe. I think there was a big tour of Europe everywhere, pretty much. And then a UK tour. And then, and I did that for quite a few years, really. But I don't think I thought about it at the time. You just kind of go into it, you know. But it was such a different world then, I think. And it felt different because there wasn't, I think the whole thing of just the internet's changed a lot of things, hasn't it? I suppose, you know, it felt more organic, if that's the right word, but it felt more natural, really, because you just go off and do it, and you'd have to be a bit more organized, I suppose, because you'd sort of need to have things written down a bit, proper itineraries and stuff. But yeah, there was a lot of time with lots of notepads on the tour bus, you know, and sort of trying to write lyrics and ideas and things. And there was a lot of time watching films and things on the bus, late 80s or something. It just felt a great time, but there's no sort of record of any of it, really, because I didn't really take pictures or anything like that, you know. But we got to go to some amazing places and some of the best gigs I've ever done. And and Dan Stewart's such a great front man. He had a bit of a like Neil Young kind of vibe, I thought, but it was that kind of feel, you know, and it just felt really genuine, powerful, rocky thing, you know, to do. So it was just something I'd started doing without really thinking about it, I suppose. That lasted a few years, and then suddenly, like, loads of other things just started coming in at that time, like being asked to do different things, you know. I think towards the late 80s, it suddenly got quite busy, and I'm not quite sure where. I'm trying to remember the first time I think it was Glenn Chilbert gave me a call, and we'd done a little gig in a sort of charity gig in Greenwich somewhere. It was just after that he sort of gave me a call. He said, "Oh, do you want to do some more gigs as part of a, you know, more of a squeeze type thing?" So we started doing some more gigs together, and suddenly we were off to America, and it ended up being a whole sort of proper tour, you know. And we ended up doing an album, and then all around that time that had finished, and then my son had just been born, so it was all quite sort of hectic, but it was a bit panicky because I thought I need to be working a lot, you know, because he's just been born. So, and strangely enough, the squeeze thing kind of pieced out a little bit. That went a bit quiet. And then suddenly the Weller camp kind of got in. Paul Weller called and left a message out of the blue. So I kind of suddenly got into that world as well. So after that, Manic Street Preachers needed someone to do stuff, but I couldn't do it at the time because I was doing the thing. It was all just suddenly got a bit mad. But it was a great time, you know. It was so busy constantly that I was pleased to be doing it, really, you know. But
if you're not in a band full time, is there that kind of, at the back of your mind, like, what's the next gig? Oh shit, am I going to be out? Like, how musicians are kind of managing their lives in that way is fascinating to me, because I love the security of a full-time job, even though I don't always love that full-time job. But if you get anxious about it at all or not?
Whether you think about it at the time, you just kind of go with it, and it all seems quite good. And it's like you just constantly do, there's like stuff to do every day, like some recording thing, you know, that with Paul Weller. I mean, it wasn't like a retainer, but there was almost every day there seemed to be something happening. Be asked to be somewhere, you know. It was either Abbey Road, you know, or some radio thing or some TV thing. They just seemed to be, like, for that year that I was playing with him, it seemed to be pretty much constant, you know, there was something. Mm. So you're so busy, really, you're not thinking about it, you know, what's next. You're just taking each day as it comes, really.
Let's dig into some of the Weller connections, because were you a Style Council fan? Was that a band that interested you? Did you ever see them live or anything?
Then, yeah, I saw them on the Tube, actually, once, when they played. I think it was on the Tube, but they were pretty, I loved the sound of it. I love mixed playing, obviously, which added a whole different sort of dimension, you know. Yeah, it's amazing how, I mean, I think it's incredible how Paul sort of went from that whole, it's a difficult thing to do, isn't it, going from the Jam to completely different sound, you know. But I always loved the Style Council sound. I thought it was quite unique and quite, you know, pretty, I don't know if daring's the word, but it was like, you know, to go from that to that and make it happen, you know, it's quite an achievement, really. I loved a lot of that stuff, and it reminds me of, I suppose it's like a time machine, isn't it, that sort of music. It reminds you of that sort of period of your life, which some of it was good. A lot of the 80s, I didn't like a lot of the music from that time. They were a great band. I think Mick Talbot, there's a funny connection there, because he sometimes, when I was doing the Paul Weller thing and the Squeeze thing, Mick Talbot was brought in to play in the big band and stuff with my brother's band. So it was kind of weird kind of connection, you know. But yeah, he's a lovely chap, and he seems to add something to the sound of what he does, you know. And I think with the Style Council, it was just the right mixture with him and the whole band. And obviously Steve's such a great drummer, isn't he? So it just seemed to, and it was quite daring, because they were pretty young, weren't they, and unheard. So it could have gone either way, but yeah, he obviously had a vision and he sort of made it work, you know. But I love a lot of those albums from that time.
Now, Weller Solo, there's so much connection with Paul Wildwood, Stanley Rhoads, and the TV show later, and Jaws and things like that. Because, you know, so much of the TV performances from around that time, he seems to be on later every week, and there were all these specials. It was fabulous. But when was the first time you got to play with him? Was it a part of later, the TV show?
I think it must have been, yeah. I'm trying to remember. Good question, isn't it? Yeah, I think it must have been when we were doing one of the, maybe the Hootenannies or something. Because we did quite a few, and he has done a few. But good question. I probably was. I remember there was one Hootenanny he did. I can't remember which one. And I remember he complimented me on my jacket.
That is high praise from Weller, right?
That's jacket, man. And I was quite pleased that he noticed it, you know, and nice playing and all that. So I said, oh, thanks. So I think it maybe sort of thought, I don't know. And it wasn't long after that I got a call from him, I guess. So he obviously, it was the same with Ray Davis, actually, when we did Hootenanny with him. And then a few bit later on, he asked me to do some stuff with him separately. But yeah, it was probably the first time we played with Paul was there, I think, probably the Hootenanny, yeah. And I remember listening, yeah, a lot of his solo albums. I mean, I listened to a lot of those when they came out, and he was on later a lot, wasn't it, at the time, I think. That was another amazing thing to go from that next kind of solo career from Style Council. And they're some of the best albums he's done as well, aren't they? And they sound different again, you know, it's like a different sound, but it's or him, I suppose, you know. But after we did the Squeeze, I think the Squeeze album we did in Helocentric Studios, which was a studio Chris Difford had at the time. And then just a year after that, I ended up doing the Helocentric tour with Paul Weller, because he'd obviously recorded in the same studio, which is a coincidence.
Yeah, maybe you were like back to back. Squeeze had got out and then Weller's got in. I think he nearly set fire to the studio or something as well.
Yeah, I can't remember. It was a great studio. It was a lovely tight place. And it was a nice memory recording this. I mean, it was all done live, the Squeeze album there. It was all quite quick, but there was quite a close connection with Squeeze and the Jam, I suppose, similar to the period growing up in the sort of that whole period, you know, I guess. And they've sort of done similar things, although I always think it's amazing how Paul seems to have done, he does the lyrics and the tunes, you know, and it's with Squeeze, obviously, it's you know, lyrics and melodies sort of generally separately, but it was coming from a similar time, I suppose, you know, although pretty different sort of bands, you know.
I remember interviewing when I was back on BBC Radio Bristol around that time, it would have been actually as a radio presenter, and I interviewed Glenn Tilbrook, and I had no idea about the separation and how they created their music. I just loved their music. So I was asking Glenn about all these lyrics. Yeah, that's Chris's. No, that's still Chris's. That's one of Chris's.
I've done a gig and someone says, oh, great drumming, you know, and they sort of, and you've just come off stage and they obviously haven't watched you at all because you know, you've been playing keyboards all night.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to quiz you about the Heliocentric tour in a sec, but I think I'm right in saying the first time you guys got into studio together was actually for a Jaws album, Lift the Lid, and a song called I'm Gone, which you've actually got a writing credit on that song as well. So you must have been involved more than just the keys, but you know what I mean. But Weller was on that song, wasn't he?
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, I think at the time, because there were lots of big band albums out each year, I think, just with various friends albums, I think they were called, weren't they? Lots of guests and stuff. Me and my older brother, we did sort of write a few things together. And that one, I think, Paul sort of guested on. So yeah, I forgot about that. But yeah, that was a good time. It was busy, you know, doing all those sort of albums every year. Yeah, so I think Paul maybe came in afterwards and did the vocal bit. I can't quite remember, but I don't remember if he was there at the time doing it live, you know. Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, and he always, as soon as he sings on site, it just goes in a different direction, doesn't it? It's amazing. And his voice seems to just got better over the years in a weird way, you know. It's so powerful, you know, which is a bit like Glenn Tilbrook from Squeeze, I think. Similar, he's got, his voice just seems to get better, you know. Some people don't, they still lose it a bit, don't they? But they've all gone from strength to strength, I think, you know.
Yeah, I was reading an interview with Paul, a fairly recent interview the other day, where he was talking about some of the Style Council stuff and the Jam stuff. And he was talking about how he feels he's a much better vocalist these days. And he was saying some of the Style Council stuff he just can't listen to, or is like really critical. And actually, when you do listen to it, you're like, vocally it's not always brilliant. Like Shouts to the Top is not a great vocal performance from Weller, but it is a terrific song. His voice now is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, some of my favorite songs or singers are, they're not great vocalists, you know, but it's just the feeling, isn't it, and the energy. And I think Paul's always had that energy and that sort of, it's almost that vibe, you know. And it's, yeah, I mean, that's my favorite. So I mean, I love, you can, you know, you, there's great singers as well, and it's almost just that thing of just being able to sing and play your own song and mean it, and people sort of feel it as well, don't they? And you get that off Paul, definitely, you know. Quite rare in some ways, isn't it, you know.
Now, the Heliocentric tour, so this was Steve White on drums, Steve Craddock, Edgar Jones on bass, who has been on the podcast recently, and I know you're really good friends, and you on keys, obviously Mr. Weller. How can I forget? Paul was involved, obviously. How did that come about? There was a gap in the band and they give you a call, or?
I remember getting a call from Paul and he left a message. I wish I'd kept it already, but he left a message on the answer machine when I was before mobile phones. It was just on an old answer machine thing, just saying, would you be interested in doing, I think it was just coming down, having a rehearsal, doing a few gigs. I wasn't really expecting it, but I remember going down and I sort of vaguely knew Steve a little bit, because Steve actually went to the same school that I went to for a little bit, as did Alan, brother, you know, who was a bit younger, who ended up playing with Oasis, obviously, you know. But yeah, I didn't know him that well. But he's, I mean, he's such an incredible drummer. And I think when I first got in the studios, it was just Steve playing. And then I started playing a bit of piano with him. And that felt great, you know. And then we used to just jam. I think he used to just jam for a few hours before rehearsals, you know. So we just had these jam sessions to see how it felt. And I'd just be jamming on the organ or the piano or stuff, and then eventually we'd sort of start rehearsing some of the songs. So it all just sort of seemed to gel naturally, really, you know. And Edgar's such a lovely bloke, so he was playing, it was fun, and it was all just fun. It felt like a fun time, you know. And I really have good memories of that little lineup and tour and stuff, because it was all nice, lovely people. Steve always, he's always the same, you know, always adds that those sort of power chords and his kind of attitude thing, which was amazing. And it felt like a really good lineup to me, yeah. And it sounded great. Listening, I think there was it the Albert Hall they recorded one of the.
Yeah, I've got it here. There's the DVD and a CD release of it live at the Royal Albert Hall.
This came in 2000 off the back of the Heliocentric album.
Yeah, and that was with the Kurt Strings that Robert Kirby was doing at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I was just trying to remember because it was such a long. It feels a long time ago now, doesn't it? But it was such a powerful sound, you know. And I love playing. I mean, when I think first thing that happened is I got sent a load of CDs of some of his stuff with ticks on the songs I think he was planning on doing, which a lot of them I'd never really sort of analysed. You know, you hear them, but you don't really, when you start listening to the keyboard parts, a lot of nice Mellotron bits and Moog bits and stuff. I thought this would be quite a nice challenge, you know, just for a change to do all these bits. So it was great to be able to, I felt a bit like, you know, like a sort of keyboard wizard being sort of set up with my Mellotron and the Moog and the Hammond and piano and Wurlitzer. So I was sort of surrounded by all these keyboards. So it was lovely just to be able to play some of those sounds on those songs, you know, and try and recapture them as best I could. And we did do a lot of really nice sort of festivals and stuff. And there was quite a few in Europe, I think. And I don't think we went to America. We went to Japan, I think.
Osaka, yeah.
Yeah, all of it just felt like a nice, happy family sort of vibe. And everyone just seemed, you know, it felt great, you know. It lasted just over a year, I think. And then Paul just started going solo, I think, started wanting to do a bit of solo stuff a little bit, which was good. And because I was doing other things, it all worked out for me quite well. But
the other people on the podcast have talked about how Paul takes the live performance very seriously. So you mentioned, like, yes, obviously you're having fun and stuff and you're doing what you love, but rehearsals are pretty full on, right?
Yeah, it seems to be, because before that, I mean, with the big band, we never really rehearsed. I mean, we rehearsed for an hour or something occasionally before a tour, a day before a tour, but we never soundcheck or rehearse much, and it keeps it fresh, you know. And lots of bands don't really, but we'd always rehearse a lot and soundcheck and stuff. But it's great, you know, because it does work, because it does sound really tight when you get together, and then you just gel, don't you? And it was great. Rehearsing, just jamming was great. You'd sort of do a load of old soul songs, and we'd sort of do, you'd start playing things like Hercules and all these things that I sort of vaguely knew anyway, but it was great fun, you know, and it's just a good way of warming up, I guess. But he seems to just love playing, doesn't he? What, even just, it's just for the fun of it, you know.
It's also interesting that it's another period in Paul's career, solo career, where he's not dug into any of the jam stuff, any of the Style Council. So you didn't get to play any of that stuff, did you?
No, it was a shame, because I always, yeah, that would have been fun, yeah. And because I mean, it's so powerful when you go up, you know, and there's a big audience sort of screaming out, and then he's I think Changing Man was the first song we used to do in the sets quite often. And it's such a powerful song to start with, you know, his guitar sound and his, you know, as a front man. It was just such a great feeling to be on stage doing that, you know. But I always thought it would have been nice to have done some of the older stuff sometimes, you know. But yeah, it never happened when I was doing it, unfortunately. But
let's talk about some of those songs. I really love Heliocentric as an album. It doesn't get mentioned a lot as Paul's kind of, I mean, God, there's so many great albums, but songs like Dust and Rocks and Frightened is such a terrific tune.
Beautiful, yeah. I was going to say that, yeah. I haven't heard them. I've still got the vinyl somewhere, which I think is probably quite rare, isn't it? I listened to it recently, and I haven't got the. It doesn't seem to be on iTunes, because I don't really do that much. But I did do some iTunes. I was trying to find Heliocentric, because I was trying to remember some of the. I didn't really want to play the vinyl, because I was trying to keep it.
You need to keep that mint. Yeah, yeah.
But that's the only version I've got of it. So I didn't really I couldn't seem to find it. So I don't know if it's quite a rare one, but it's it had some great songs. Yeah, Frightened. Dust and Rocks was great. Yeah, it was really powerful. That one of my favourite ones, I think, with the sort of weird Moog bits and all that stuff. Very, very moving song. Frightened, it was good, because he just played that on the piano, and then it was just piano and organ, a lot of that one. Was there one Picking Up Sticks on that? Was that on that?
That's
one?
Right. Yeah, yeah. Picking Up Sticks,
Paul, Steve, Paul would get off stage, and we'd stand at the side and Steve would go into a drum solo. And it was like literally, you know, your hair's tingling on the back of your chest because he was such a, he did such an amazing solo every night, Steve. And I was just like blown away by it every night, you know.
Oh, he's incredible, isn't it? Absolutely. But there's some really great songs from his catalogue on that tour. So things like Heavy Soul, You Do Something to Me, you mentioned Changing Man, Peacock Suit and stuff. But I have to mention Woodcutter's Son, which often would be like the finale, but the keys on that, man alive.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. No, that's another one. I think a lot of Mellotron on that, but yeah, it's a powerful song again, isn't it? It wasn't, yeah, it was great fun. It was just a challenge, really, just to try and do it as best you can, you know. So it was, there was a lot of fiddling about for me, but seemed to get away with it, I think.
Now, you mentioned about Keyboard Wizard, or I mean, the amount that you can play, but how much did you take on that tour? Can you remember what you had with you? Because I mean, you mentioned things like Moogs and Mellotron and Rhodes, and I mean, I know you played like Wurlitzer and Hammond, keyboards, all kinds of stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe some people probably got it all in one keyboard now, haven't they? You just got, it's got
press a button, yeah.
But it was nice because we had the Hammond organ, the I think it was, yeah, there was a Moog, had a Moog, which was at the side on top of the Mellotron. So it was a genuine Mellotron, but that was Paul's Mellotron. And well, it's and a piano sound pretty much. So yeah, I think it was five keyboards or something like that. Yeah, I should have got a cape really, shouldn't I? Gone the whole thing. No.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's nice to use the original sounds, you know, and it did definitely the proper keyboards. You know, it does sound different, you know, than some of these other things that people use. It sounded amazing, and it looks good, doesn't it, having that whole thing up there. So,
how did it differ? Can you remember how it differed when the orchestra came in for that Royal Albert Hall gig or gigs? I think there were a couple of nights because they weren't with you the whole of the tour, were they? No. That was just a thing.
I remember chatting with Robert. I mean, I wasn't really aware of him, but I knew obviously he'd done Nick Drake's albums, and he was such a lovely man, you know, just so knowledgeable about music. And yeah, I remember just thinking, wow, this sounds incredible. Just we rehearsed it first, and you couldn't really hear the orchestra as loud. But when we got to the Albert Hall, we sound checked, and you could hear the powerfulness of it. You know, did you go to that gig at all? I don't know.
I wasn't there. I'm trying to think where I was living. I was probably in Bristol or something. It was probably London was probably a very scary place for me back then. I've absolutely caned that DVD though. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I hope it sounded good out front, but on stage it sounded really powerful. You know, with the strings behind and the sort of mixture of that and the band, I think it worked so well. And I'm just glad. Yeah, I'm glad they captured it.
Yeah, I think Edgar said that his mum's got his copy.
Right. Yeah, I think I've seen clips of it. I think Steve White actually sent me. I didn't know it was out there. And then I think Steve White sent me a clip of it on YouTube or something. And it was, yeah, I think it was Dustin Rocks, which is probably one of my favourite ones. I think from that time, it always felt really moving to do. You know, that one. And and Fireson was another really powerful one. They said, yeah.
I love the other thing I loved around that time, because I did go to that tour. It just wasn't that gig. Was these things? Have you seen this? You know,
yeah, vaguely remember that. Yeah,
so these were the match day programs. This was volume 6, designed by Simon Halfen, and all the photography from Lawrence Watson, who's been on the podcast. And you just got these beautiful books, which just seems such a strange thing now to kind of, you buy the, you know, and then you're clutching this throughout the whole gig, you know, in the mosh pit. But just beautifully produced, and Paul's always like love the visual element of his music and bringing it to life and stuff. But there we are. There's a little mention. There you are. Look, Paul Weller, Steve White, Steve Craddock, Edgar Jones, Chris Holland.
I love the artwork on that. It's great, isn't it? I think that whole album is brilliant, you know, and it does seem to be underlooked a little, doesn't it, maybe in his thing. But yeah, it was nicely packaged, and yeah, just happy memories really of the whole thing, you know. It was nice to delve into that world and see how it all works, you know, and meet his dad. Obviously, he's a bit of obviously a legend, and the whole experience was, yeah, it was nice, good timing as well. As I said, my son had just been born, and I don't think I'd ever been paid so much for a gig, you know. So it suddenly went into the world. It was brilliant.
As you've mentioned, John, I mean, and I'm imagining with a young son, you didn't get fooled by this, but were you part of the Cards school on the tour? Did you get involved in playing the Cards?
Little, but not a lot. But I thought it reminded me of my kind of. My grandparents a little bit used to play cards a lot, you know, with them, and it was nice seeing John and Kenny at the end of the whenever they're, you know, playing. He said, "Come and have a game," and he'd sort of give you a whiskey or something, you know. But I just couldn't. I think I did a couple, and I think the first one I did, he said, "Oh, well, that will be your PD's gone for the next kind of few days." Had a chance, to be honest, you know, but it was nice to have a go, you know, but it was quite a good way of getting out of paying PDs, you know.
As you know, Chris, I do my research on the podcast here, right? So 2012, there's a tweet from you. I'm not expecting you to remember everything you tweeted about in 2012, right? But I'm going to read it to you. He said, spotted this nice old 70s poster hanging next to the organ while recording with Paul Weller today. I should probably share a screen, which would be easier. But it was this kind of green poster and the Jam were on it. I think this would have been for September in the Rain, I would guess, around that time, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
It was September the 15th, 2012. Was your tweet?
My brother's studio, where we rehearse a lot, there's quite a lot of old posters. I think that must be a really old poster from the 70s. Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting, isn't it? Because, yeah, I think that's next to the organ in my brother's studio. So I think I was playing the organ. I looked at the date and noticed it was the same date, and that poster was on the wall next to me. So I thought it was a bit freaky. And it's basically Squeeze, the Jam on the same bill. At the Greyhound pub, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we had Babyface on the Monday, Handbag on the Tuesday, Squeeze on the Wednesday, Red Beans Rice on the Thursday. I don't know if that was a meal or a band.
No, Red Beans and Rice actually was, I vaguely remember them, and they had a Mike Pace, who used to play my brother's first band, The Millionaires. He was a sort of harmonica and saxophone player who's sadly no longer here, but they were like a New Orleansy kind of sort of funky type band, yeah.
Then we have what we've got, Spangled Mob on the Friday, The Jam on the Saturday, completely different logo wording for the band as well, and then the Sunday, yeah. Capability Brown,
brilliant, excellent, yeah, that's cool, isn't it? It's like a nice sort of time warp of what it was like then. Yeah, I was a bit like the Marquee. I remember going up to the Marquee pretty much every weekend when I was about 15 or 16, and I didn't really like, you know, lessons too much at school, and I used to bunk off going to the music lesson a lot, music rooms, and just practice piano. And I'd sort of sneak off early sometimes, go up to the Marquee, and then they always let me in somehow, and then just started watching different bands up there every night. And there'd always be posters like that with different bands on, you know, you never heard half of them, but some of them were great, you know, and it'd be a great way of listening to it. And then a little bit later on with the band I had with us from school, you know, we ended up playing residency there pretty much every week. So it was great, that kind of time, wasn't it? Those posters, you'd see them all over London, wouldn't you, all the different bands and stuff. And yeah, it did seem quite a magical time, you know, all that, really.
Well, no, yeah, in fact, you can see live music every single night, which is just not a thing now, really.
Just a good time. But strange enough, I can't remember the details, but I know Lisa, who played and used to play with our first band, I remember she did an audition for the Style Council a bit later, and I can't quite remember how it came about, because she played guitar. There weren't that many sort of female guitar players at that time, you know, it's quite a bit unusual, I think. And they were looking for female guitarists, I think, in the Style Council. And I think she almost got the job, but it's like between her and obviously someone else. But I remember her telling me about it. I can't remember the details. Interesting.
When you tweeted that must have been when you're in the studio, in Jules's studio. Was that the last time you recorded with Paul?
It probably was. Yeah, I'm guessing. Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember what it was. Or it might have been rehearsing for the Hootenanny or something. I can't remember the last time we did it with him, but it's been a few times, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, even the Amy Winehouse Hootenanny, you were in that band at that point, weren't you?
Yes. Yeah, that was an amazing one, wasn't it? We were probably rehearsing, and I remember just looking at this, and he'd sort of be, and I was, the organ's up on a sort of raised level, so I was sort of, you should look down on everyone, so he'd be down there rehearsing, you know, playing and rehearsing. But then I think I just looked at the side of me and saw the Jam poster, and it seemed quite a strange kind of significant thing, really. That was probably one of the most memorable times playing with Paul and with the big band, you know, with Amy Winehouse one. That was quite special, really, you know. That's probably on YouTube, isn't it, the clip of
it is, yeah, it's just, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Like Don't Go to Strangers, just absolutely stunning, isn't it?
Yeah. And I don't think we'd rehearsed it that much. It was pretty much, you know, just done quite quickly.
I don't understand. Like, when you say that, it's like, I can't get my head around that. Like, the fact that there's very little rehearsal, you just bang into it. So how do you spend weeks and weeks prepping for these kind of guest appearances on things like Hootenanny and to learn the music and understand your bits of it as individuals?
No, really. I think it's all quite last minute, because we're usually on the end of a tour, the winter tour with the big band. And then suddenly you get this load of songs. They keep changing and the guests want to change the keys or the songs. And it seems to just be quite constantly changing. So you have to keep kind of, you know, updating what information you have. And then we end up getting into the studio for like one day just to rehearse it all. And generally the horn arrangers will arrange the horns section, and then rhythm section will work their own parts out, and it will all kind of come together. But we only really get a day to rehearse it, you know, and then we go straight in the BBC and do it pretty much like as it is, you know. Well, I don't know, they always seem to make it work somehow, you know. But
and it's amazing. I mean, it's magical TV. I love Hootenanny. I was down under this new year just gone, so I didn't see it live, so I watched it back subsequently. It was weird being in Australia because the whole kind of Christmas thing doesn't really happen and whatever. And I was like, hold on, what's there's nothing on telly in Australia at all apart from the fireworks. They show the fireworks. I was like, where's you need the Hootenanny? What's going on?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's amazing. It's been going that long, isn't it? And it's like the tradition of it. I mean, it has changed since the COVID thing as well. I think it's changed because the audience had to, you know, that we had to do it without the audience, and then it's gradually coming back. But and also when it was at the original, you know, the iconic BBC, you know, up in Shepherd's Bush, that helps, I think, for the whole thing. But I mean, it's amazing they're still doing it as it is. And it's, I mean, hats off to my brother, really, for keeping all that stuff together so long, because it's quite an achievement, isn't it? How long he's been doing all that, you know, it's incredible already.
You mentioned COVID, the dreaded C word, but as a touring musician, your entire world disappears, but you kept yourself pretty busy with a number of music projects during that time.
Yeah, I mean, it was quiet as far as gigs went, and like there was no money as far as all that went, you know, which is the main income to musicians, you know. But it was a good opportunity to try and get a load of songs finished that I'd been working on, I suppose. And I'm always chipping away. I mean, I just do it because I love it, really. It's not, you know, like, but I'm always chipping away at song ideas and writing and recording. So it was a good chance to finish a lot of that stuff, you know. I mean, I'm not that technical, but I've got a little basic home studio set up, you know. So it was good to get more into that, really, and, you know, spend a bit more time having a clear out of stuff, which is what you keep putting off, you know, and just trying to kind of have minimal things around and not have too much clutter. So yeah, it was a good chance to do all that, I guess, you know. It got quite desperate for a while, didn't it, when there was literally nothing, you know. And it was because that's all I've ever done, really, you know, and you don't really think of anything else, you know. So it was a weird old time, but we seem to be getting through it now. So looking back, weird. I did a little charity. There was this one for the NHS. So a friend of mine who'd been helping manage me a little bit had put together this sort of charity album. So I did a song for that. And also my mum passed away just before COVID. It wasn't to do with COVID, but she'd just been getting a bit poorly before. So it was nice to do something for that. Yeah, I think I did two charity singles in that time, best I could. But it was difficult because I was just doing it at home pretty much on my own, and I didn't have any, had limited technical knowledge, really. So it was done quite basically. But yeah, no, it was nice to keep busy and just be creative, really, in that time.
It was, so, and I'll put these in the show notes. A Great Awakening was the one for raising money for NHS Heroes, the album Songs of Isolation. So that was right in the midst of the kind of COVID crisis, if you like. And then the second lockdown song you mentioned, so that was dedicated to your mum, right? So that was Thank You for the Love.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically, it's just ideas I'd had, really, but that was because she sort of had quite bad dementia at the end, and it was a little charity thing for that, and all the people that are so, you know, amazing who help out in the care home she was, you know. And they just, and it was a really difficult time for them, you know, and you couldn't go in and see her half the time, you know, because of that COVID thing. But yeah, it was just sort of dedicating it to them, really, in a, I suppose, in a little way. But it was just also, it was an experiment to try and do stuff on my own, really, because I'd never done that before. I usually go in and do it with a band or something, you know. But it was quite nice just to do it as best I could on my own. So the sound sonically wasn't brilliant, but it was just trying to get it out.
I imagine that's quite liberating, so to be in control of and being able to do it all yourself, and kind of or do you miss that kind of camaraderie and that bouncing ideas off people?
Yeah, I think a bit of both, you know. I've still got a band that I play, like we do sort of fun gigs with sometimes, parties and stuff, just for fun with different people. And it's always nice just to play live, isn't it, with other people, and you bounce off things. I think that is the best way to capture a song, if you've got the song worked out, and by playing it live a lot, obviously, you know, and then you capture that magic. But a lot of the time I've got a song half done, so I'm sort of writing it as I'm going along almost. So you put the idea down and build it up that way, and then add things on after. There's all different ways of doing it, you know. But I mean, that's one of the things I'm sort of curious about Paul Weller's songwriting, really, you know, because it is so incredible, a lot of it. And you wonder where he gets all these ideas and his process of how he, when he gets the idea in his head, does he then just jam it with a band, or does he sort of, you know, how does he actually, the process of him actually going from, you know, it's like a blank canvas, isn't it? You've got this sort of idea, but you want to get it down. It never sort of works out quite how you have it in your mind, you know, but how does he go from that process of getting it into a sort of actual finished product, you know?
It's also that thing of like, there doesn't seem to be many periods where he talks about writer's block at all. And we're talking over 45 years now. It's just remarkable, isn't it? Like over 450 songs, I think I worked out the other day.
Yeah, and it's so poetic. I mean, it's so poetic, you know, from you know, just looking at, you know, where does he get these ideas? It could be like a book of poems, almost some of the words, couldn't it? And you just wonder how he gets so many inspired ideas, you know? And it's, because I mean, I love writing all the time, always getting ideas and notepads and writing a song. I've got millions of ideas, you know, but it is a constant thing, you know, you have to rewrite and change things. But his ones just he seems to have so many all the time, and he never seems to tire of it, you know. It's incredible, really, isn't it? Time consuming as well, mustn't it, for people around him, you know, because you have to go into that whole zone, don't you? You can't almost do anything else. But yeah, he seems to manage to do it all, doesn't he, and do everything else.
It's been a while since we've had an album from you. It's been a few years. How do you approach the kind of making of a new project? Because you mentioned at the start of this that you've been working on an EP in the early hours.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of almost finished pretty much. But with that one, I've almost been doing most of it myself. And then I've been bringing in a few people just to add bits too. But it's almost finished pretty much. So I'm just trying to work out how I'm going to get it mixed, really, because hopefully the guy Ron Box, who's helped me in the past, is able to do it, and then I'll just get it out there as a little thing, you know, this year. But yeah, part of it is, I mean, it is all part of it's, you know, the technical thing and the cost and all that stuff. I mean, like the last album I had out, I ended up getting a lot of CDs made up, but a lot of, I don't know if people think, some people say they're coming back, some sort, but it's nice to have a physical thing as well, isn't it? You know, and obviously vinyl is the best thing, but it is expensive now, you know, to get vinyls printed up, particularly if you're going to get coloured ones or different ones, you know, and then you've got to carry them around. So it is a tricky thing to work out, you know, but I just do it because I love it, really, you know, and it's just, I can't seem to stop, you know. As soon as I sit down at a keyboard, you just come up with some idea and you just think, oh, where's that going to go? And then you almost don't want to do it because you just think, well, you want to finish it, but, you know, it's quite time consuming, isn't it? I think as you get older to do it also.
You'll know from listening to the podcast, like Paul's not, seems like a nocturnal character, from the text to people in the middle of the night to the making music into the very early hours. It's that thing of just once you start getting into it, you don't want to walk away. You're in that zone, I guess.
Yeah, and often you're lying in bed, you can't sleep, because you all these songs go around your head. You tell, oh, yeah, and then you get the best ideas in the morning, suddenly, you know, at night. And you, I used to have a little, well, it's next to the bed, literally, and I'd sort of start playing at night because you get these ideas and record it down on your phone or something. But you have all these ideas, melodies and songs, you know. But yeah, I mean, I find melodies easy, but I think lyrics are the hard thing for personally, you know. And I've done a few with Chris Difford's given me a few lyrics in the past, you know, and that's another quite hard thing, I think, to write. I mean, I don't know how Glenn Tilbert does that, you know, write to lyrics, because that's quite tricky. And I've sort of made it work a bit, but I find it much more natural to, it sort of happens at the same time almost. You've got a melody and then you kind of work out, the lyrics seem to come fall into the meter of the rhythm that you've got. But yeah, to come out with original lyrics, I suppose you can only write what you know about, really, you know, but it's quite tricky to get that balance, I think.
Yeah, I've always found that dynamic fascinating, particularly when, you know, Chris was sending Glenn the lyrics in the post, you know, and these would arrive. Whereas now, I think Chris, when he was on the podcast, he was talking about actually he might have a little melody in his mind when he's writing the stuff, but Glenn will just go off and do his own thing or whatever, which is,
yeah.
But yeah, you just literally, these lyrics are just arriving in the post and then suddenly you're making music to them. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it must be inspiring to have that, if, you know, when the way they used to do that, and he just sort of put it under the door, didn't, when they lived in the same flat, in different flats together in the same building, and Glenn would kind of come up with the melody. It's a magical way of working. It's a bit like the old sort of musicals, isn't it, how they used to write all the old sort of classic sort of songs. But it's quite a skill, I think, you know, which not everyone has, you know. Paul does it all himself in different ways, and then, I mean, Glenn has done lots of solo albums as well where he's done both, you know, so it's interesting, isn't it? It's all different ways of doing it, you know. I mean, growing up, a lot of my influences, singer-songwriters, people like Randy Newman, for example, you know, he'd just sit at the piano and it'd be pretty much piano and voice, but that was really powerful, you know, and he's probably one of the greatest lyricists, you know, of all time, you know, but I always found that inspiring, just keeping it really simple, just the piano and the voice, you know. It's an interesting, I don't know, the whole thing of creating something, you know, from nothing is always fascinating, I think, you know.
I love that idea, yeah, of the you're going into the studio sometimes with very little, or you're going into your little room and or whatever, and then you're coming out and you're making, there's a the finished complete song that we all get to, and that could live on forever. It's mental.
You get it out there and you never know where it's going to go. It's like having loads of babies and they just go out and they do their, grow up and do their own thing. And yeah, it's just, it's interesting, isn't it? It's fascinating, kind of, particularly now, because of, you know, it can just end up anywhere, can't it, on the, in the world, you know, whereas before it wasn't really possible, was it, I suppose.
Lovely to chat with you. I'm so glad that we managed to sort this out. I do have two questions for you before you go there, all right?
Fire away. I think you're going to be, because I've been listening to some of your podcasts.
Well, hopefully you'll have an answer then. So you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Star Council, or Solo. What are you going to go with?
Well, I was thinking, I do love Dustin Rox, only because you mentioned that, because it was from that sort of period that, and it has fond memories, you know, when we were playing it live. But also listening, talking about Mick Talbot and his playing, and one of my favourite Paul Weller songs is, I think Wings of Speed was really powerful, because I remember he did that, I think he did it on the Glacier as well, but because it was just piano and organ, you know, and I think Mick did say about when recording the organ, it was like a church organ in a chapel. But I don't know, I thought that is quite a gospel feel almost, that song, isn't it? But it was sort of simple, but his lyrics, his vocals are really powerful on that, and it's quite emotional, that one, isn't it?
That's Carleen Anderson on that one as well, isn't it?
Amazing, yeah. Got a nice sound feel about it, isn't it? Something a bit spiritual one.
Good choice, man, good choice. Right, so final question, purpose of this podcast, it's to talk to lovely people like yourself, obviously, and hear your stories, but it's really for me to get the interview with Paul Weller that I never managed during my radio career. If it happens, what should I ask him?
Well, yeah, I was thinking, I mean, apart from the obvious things, has he listened to all the podcasts on this? Hopefully he has, you know. I'm curious about how he gets the inspiration, you know, for his lyrics and his process of writing, you know, and how does he actually write a song, you know, and he gets the ideas, and then how does he get that from nothing to the finished thing, you know? I don't know maybe he has talked about it in the past, probably in interviews, but it's always fascinating, I think, to find out how someone does that, you know. I mean, that's something I'd personally be curious to know about, you know, how he actually writes a song from scratch, you know, and how it starts off, you know. Is it like a germ of an idea in his head, you know, and does he sit down and write the whole lyrics? And I don't know, I think it's probably different for each song, maybe, you know, but be curious to find out his process, you know.
So yeah, that bit of at which point does it come out of your head and onto something, whether it's a lyric or a little melody or a little note, yeah, or whatever. At what point does he think, oh, this is worth recording somewhere, writing down or whatever? Yeah
and then it's quite hard sometimes to capture that, isn't it, you know, get that spark, you know, and does he just do loads of versions till he gets it right? I mean, you know, sometimes you can't do that, you know, if you've not got, but he's got his studio, he can do it as much as he wants probably until he's happy with it. But some of the early stuff, I suppose, with the Jam stuff, because it was quite probably done pretty much live quite quickly, wasn't it, and you don't have time to really think about it, whereas now people can keep changing stuff and sort of dissecting it a bit. But you know, I don't know if that's always a good thing, is it? But yeah, and has he got a new album out, sort of on the way? Do you know, is there anything coming?
There's talk of it. So I read an interview and people have mentioned to me, I think the next one's going to be a triple album. Not this year, probably next year, I think was what. And I think he mentioned this in Mojo Magazine, one of the interviews. But yeah, I mean, yeah, he's not slowing down, right?
Right, that's incredible, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, we saw him quite recently. We did a Prostrate Cancer gig at the Albert Hall. He seemed the same as ever, you know. And I said to him, it's amazing, because the last time I was here with him was when we did that tour, you know. It was a great gig because there was Rod Stewart was doing it with us, and he's obviously a Rod fan as well. So it was just a nice atmosphere on stage. We all sort of, everyone was just sort of playing and chatting. But he said, yeah, I remember here. He said, yeah, it was great. Happy memories of that gig, you know. And it was nice just to sort of see him and he doesn't seem to ever stop, you know. Which is, I don't know where he gets that sort of energy and that form, you know, particularly after he's just had twins, and he's just, I think because there was into a lot of drinking going on at the time when I was there, and it's that must have been quite tiring. I couldn't keep up, you know, but I think that stopped. So that's probably given a new lease of life, maybe, you know. But it's amazing his energy, isn't it? And how he just kind of seems to just keep cool and keep doing it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how they managed to do any gigs with the amount of alcohol consumption back in the day.
I mean, it was quite, I think that was generally after, wasn't it? But yeah, it was quite tiring.
Yeah, but the hangover next day, you don't want to be bloody, oh god.
It was fun times, you know, but it's moved on a bit, yeah. But it sounds great now, doesn't it, what he's doing? I mean, it sounds just as good in a different way, you know, and it's good he keeps it fresh all the time, you know, which I think is important, isn't it?
Well, think also like when you bring in an orchestra, when to bring in an orchestra and do something different there, like you did at the with the other aspects gigs, or yeah, when you need keys in the band or not. And it's kind of constantly kind of reshaping the band, reshaping the sound to do a few different things. Or when it's just him and an acoustic guitar, that Days of Speed tour, which came off the back of the Heliocentric tour you mentioned, is that was just fabulous, you know, just Paul and an acoustic guitar.
Yeah, exactly. That was unique, wasn't it? Again, I think his voice is so strong, you know, you can, and it's so distinct, isn't it? But I think ultimately it comes down to the song, doesn't it? If you know, it's having a great song, you know. And another great one was You Do Something to Me, because I remember that was a really powerful one to do, and with the Mellotron, you know. And I think when you've got a great song, it's easy almost to play it, you know, because or record it, because it's always going to sound great, isn't it?
Well, look, digging into the process is on my list, so Paul's going to tell us about that when the interview with Mr. Weller happens. We're going to dig into that. We'll get back to you, and we'll let you know how. Well, you'll hear it on the podcast, but yeah. we'll find out about the process.
No, definitely, yeah. No, it's like anything, isn't it? But yeah, it's got to be soon. I'm sure he's going to be on this year. It's what number is this?
Oh, what are we up to? You're episode 131, Christopher.
He's waiting to hear someone say something bad about him, and then he's just
yeah, the whole thing's over.
It's amazing. It's lovely. It's such a great thing to have done, you know, and well done on that.
Oh, bless you.
I hope he listens to them all, basically. Yeah, it'd be good, wouldn't it?
Oh, thank you so much for your time, man. I've loved spending time with you. I've loved chatting. Yeah. It's been really lovely.
You see some gig some point down the road somewhere, but nice to meet you, Dan. Yeah, take care.
Well, that was wonderful. Christopher Holland, another very fine individual, joining the podcast to share his stories. A lovely, lovely chap. And what an amazing career again. Music, collaboration, and more. Head to my website for the show notes to this podcast episode, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. And whilst you're there, you know the drill, right? You can find merchandise in our official store. Plus, you can also buy a virtual coffee as well. It all helps to support the podcast with our hosting fees on Acast, websites, so on. Cheers for all your support on the roll call this week. Mark D, who says, "Hi Dan, I've listened from the start and your podcast has been an integral part of my week. So thought I should better buy you a coffee to say thank you. Love the Stuart Prosser episode reminiscing about the Style Council. Happy days." Thank you, Mark. Much appreciated. Hello to Steve Henson. Thanks to you for your virtual coffee. John Reed. Thank you, sir. Alex McLaughlin says, "Stuart Prosser was another star in the Weller sky, another guest it would be great to have a pint with." You're absolutely right. I do like the idea that Christopher had, by the way, for the wrap-up at the end of the series. Just all the guests, a lovely big party. Martin Bonhoms bought you a coffee. Thank you, Martin. Mike C. Thank you, sir. Simon Cartledge. Hello to you. Martin Glover. Thanks to you for your virtual coffee. Cheers for all of you. Thanks for your support. Really do appreciate it. If you want to get involved, just head to my website, grab a virtual coffee in the store for a shout out on the show next week. Now, talking of things that are really, really exciting, two things I want you to get involved in. Number one, we now have an occasional music show on Mixcloud. So one of the frustrations with the podcast, there aren't many, but one of the things that you can't really do because of licensing and all that is play music. So we now have a place on Mixcloud where we can do exactly that. The show's called Cobweb Connections. We'll probably do it monthly, but the idea is it is brand new music from people who have been on the podcast or people who are on our wish list. Essentially, people with Paul Weller connections. Have a listen. Mixcloud, search for Desperately Seeking Paul or Paul Weller Fan Podcast. You should find it there, or head to my website for more details. Would love you to listen. Second thing, we are going to be announcing some live shows very, very soon. All right. Live podcasts in 2023. Make sure you follow on social media for all the announcements. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. If you're not on social media, just head to my website and make sure you follow there too. We'll share the announcements via that. And you can always get in touch too. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.